It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Tens of thousands of Pittsburgh area residents remain jobless due to the pandemic and the resulting recession. The unemployment rate hit a high of 16.4% in April. After 2 months of declines, it popped up to 14.5% in July, according to the Department of Labor and Industry. So, what sectors are leading the slow recovery process? Which ones are lagging behind? Jim Futrell is Vice President of Market Research and Analysis at the LENA Conference for Community Development, which has released a report on the employment picture. Jim, the Pittsburgh area lost more than 200,000 jobs from February through April. How many have we regained?
From April through July, we've regained approximately 107,000, which is 53% of what we had lost over the February to April period. So that's kind of the good news, because nationwide, the country has only regained 42%. So we're running a little bit ahead of the country right now. A lot of that was driven early on by the rebound in construction, because as many of us know, the construction market was shut down for much of March and into April, unlike you saw elsewhere in the country. So that really kind of drove the initial rebound.
53%, you said that's the good news, but why just 53%? The shutdown is over. Is it because businesses have just closed up shop, or they're not hiring back as many workers as they let go? What's the reasoning behind that?
What you need to do is look to the industry breakdown of where the shortfall currently is. So here in the Pittsburgh region, 1/3 of the jobs that have not been made up yet are in the leisure and hospitality sector. The restaurants sector has been challenged with, they were able to reopen to a certain extent, and then they had to dial that back. And now going into September, they're going to go back to, the 50% occupancy. A lot of the hotels here have yet to reopen. And some of the tourist attractions here in the region have been reopening on with abbreviated staffing levels. And another 17% fell into educational services. So, Pittsburgh being a major hub for colleges and universities, you see a lot of downsizing there. So I think really what will determine how quickly that other 47% is regained is going into fall to see how much of the educational services industry rebounds. And hopefully you start to see some hiring picking up in the leisure and hospitality sector again.
You mentioned the Pittsburgh region regaining lost jobs compared to the national. How do we compare with maybe other cities in terms of losses and what has returned?
We benchmark against 15 other regions around the country to give us a sense of, markets that we're looking to be like, markets that we are like, markets we compete with. Among the 15 benchmark regions, only four regained a higher percentage of the jobs that were lost in that February to April period. Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Denver, and Detroit were all in that category. So I think, when you look at it in the context of our benchmark cities, we're doing pretty well. Cleveland, which we all like to compare ourselves to, we regained 40%. So they're lagging a little bit behind. Charlotte, who we compete with in a lot of economic development projects, is at 36%.
Jim, what are the sectors that are rebounding in our region?
107,000 jobs that had been regained over that April to July period. About a quarter of those were in construction, which was more than twice the percentage nationwide. Retail was another major contributor. And, of course, healthcare, that was 18% of the jobs regained compared to 11% nationally. So healthcare here helped drive a lot of that rebound. Leisure and hospitality, while in terms of the highest proportion of that 107,000, it was about 1/3 of the jobs. Nationwide, about 1/2 of the jobs regained over the April to July period were in leisure and hospitality.
So what are the impediments that might sort of block or hinder continued improvement in those sectors you just mentioned?
as we've moved out of kind of what I would consider the low-hanging fruit in the rebound, you know, the construction, the retail, the stores reopened, the healthcare as, you know, elective procedures were beginning to be permitted again. You know, a lot of it's going to depend on consumer confidence. Do people feel comfortable going out again? It's going to probably, you know, I think, slow down a bit as, you know, people just kind of feel out what's going on in the world going forward. I mean, I think how quickly a vaccine goes into widespread distribution, we start to rebuild consumer confidence.
And for those sectors that are lagging behind, are you concerned that they will ever fully recover?
I wouldn't say never. I think some will be slower than others. If, for instance, you know, a lot of economists are projecting that the airline industry won't be back to 2019 levels until 2024. A lot of the tourism segments, you see projections into 2022. So those kinds of sectors, yeah, it's going to take a little bit longer to recover. It's going to be a while before we get back to where we were a year ago. But, you know, I think there will be some areas such as, you know, construction, technology, professional services that will help support the economy.
Jim Futrell is Vice President of Market Research and Analysis at the Allegheny Conference for Community Development. Jim, thanks for your time.
Certainly.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. During the pandemic, living rooms and kitchens have become classrooms, and school districts have scrambled to secure computers and other technology for students. But for families without secure housing, this school year could pose even more challenges. Carlos Carter is the executive director of the Homeless Children's Education Fund. Carlos, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much.
Many local school districts have started the term online, have given students computers and Wi-Fi hotspots so they can do their classwork, but that doesn't necessarily mean kids have a physical space to work in. Are the students that you serve experiencing that?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. Some students, you know, especially students that are doubled up with other families, that type of homelessness, they a lot of times don't have their own space, or especially a quiet space. It's definitely challenging for them.
How about for schools doing synchronous learning, you know, that real-time Zoom classes? Are devices, access to devices, an issue for some families, for some homeless kids?
Oh my God, yes. It's a lot of stress because, like, some families only have a cell phone. I do know that some districts have been providing technology, and we have as well, but you also have to look at making sure they have logins. A lot of families haven't been able to log in, and just being able to navigate the technology. I know Pitt and others have created support lines, and so that's important that families know about these resources. But a lot of times they don't have enough devices. That's a challenge, you know, and since everybody's ordering devices, they're on backlog. So there's a lot going on, you know, things that districts can't control either, but that is a lot of stress for parents, we've heard, like, you know, not having enough devices. With, you know, the synchronous learning, that's a big challenge for sure.
How might issues like learning loss be exacerbated for homeless students?
Well, you know, when you think, Kevin, in terms that, you know, kids experiencing homelessness are four times more likely than their stably housed peers to be developmentally delayed, you know, for every move they're pushed back, you know, in school 6 months, and they're twice as likely of disabilities. So for our students, there are already many barriers, and, you know, our students are very intelligent, they're bright, they're resilient, but when you're dealing with all these stress and uncertainty, your ability to learn is more challenged. And so when you add COVID and further isolation, you know, as I've said before, I think on this program or others, that, you know, these situations, they create, but they also reveal inequities. So, like, you know, whereas all families aren't being impacted, you know, I've talked to middle class families that are really struggling, worried. I'm like, I understand your concern, but imagine what our families are facing. You know, they can't afford basic necessities. You know, it's a lot going on. And so it definitely is not good for a lot of our students, a lot of anxiety for them and their parents.
Are you worried about students and families who were already at risk slipping through the cracks during this pandemic?
I am. And that's why, you know, when people think in terms of advocacy, They think in terms of policy. Yes, one has to impact and change policy in the government system, but also with systems of organizations and school districts, just making sure that we're bringing, you know, the voice of our young people and their families to the forefront and supporting them, you know, making sure they're getting meals, you know, picking up things for them, whatever we can. Because a lot of times people don't always think of our students, because all students are struggling, right? But like, how do we help our students as well? And so we've been working with like the Pittsburgh Learning Collaborative with A-plus schools and Remake Learning and a lot of the other great organizations. So we've been working with these organizations to make sure that we're, you know, making certain parties aware and that we're advocating to support these students. But yeah, definitely concerns me. I don't like to worry, but I do worry about these students. It breaks my heart, you know, what they face, but I just know the great potential they have if we can support them. And so HCF is going to continue to do what we can do to help these kids, you know, succeed, because education, you know, is a big key to ultimate success and breaking the cycle of homelessness. Because, you know, students who don't graduate from high school or go to GED, I think, are 4.5 times more likely to experience homelessness. It's the greatest predictor. And so it's important that we continue to push and advocate for our kids and families and empowering and supporting them. And we will continue to do that. We have great donors and volunteers and supporters and relationships, but we keep pushing.
Students who experience housing instability, they're already dealing with a lot of stress. Now with the pandemic and the start of a new school year, are you seeing kids' stress levels increasing?
Yes, from some, of course, I haven't been dealing with a lot of kids directly, but they're talking with my team, absolutely. I mean, a lot of kids are a lot of uncertainty, right? And I think even around homelessness generally, it's the uncertainty that hurts people, right? People like routine, people like predictability. Our young people don't have that. And this, and really the big thing too, Kevin, is losing connectivity with the school, right? And so every teacher has a different level of skill set, right? And credit to the teachers, a lot of them haven't necessarily been used to teaching online, you know what I mean? And so like losing that safety net and connection socially and the meals they would get and things of that nature, all that, it definitely impacts them. And then when for districts that are giving out meals, so if you're, say if you went to school in Penn Hills and now you're in Wilkinsburg, for example, so Wilkinsburg doesn't have to feed you the meals, right? Because like, the government, I don't think, reimbursed for that. And how can you get all the way to Penn Hill? So that's an issue that our students, you know, will be facing with that. So it's a lot. And again, I hate to be negative. You know, I try to be hopeful and positive, but definitely I'm concerned. But again, we continue to work with all our partners to advocate and support our students.
You say you hate to be negative. You try to be positive. So positively, what can you look forward to this school year for the kids and the families you work with?
Well, I know that at HCF, we know that we'll continue to support them. We'll be a resource. So if our families need computers, if they need food or whatever they need that we can do, that we will help them, we'll advocate for them. You know, we'll still have our tutors available and, you know, still try to engage them in a lot of our enrichment programming, you know, remotely. But just knowing that they have somebody they can talk to, they can turn to, who will support and advocate. And so I do look forward to that. And the potential, right? Our kids are resilient, right? And so one of the greatest factors for, you know, kids being resilient is having a loving, caring, and supportive adults. You know, and our people are amazing. And so I think the love and support that we give, because again, education is important, but as I say in our video, Raising Hope, that we want our kids to feel loved, supported, and valued, and their social emotional is paramount to us. And so knowing that they have that, you know, and even escape with our different, you know, fun activities we provide as well. And we've been sending, you know, packages of love to them and just letting them know that we see them.
Carlos Carter is the executive director of the Homeless Children's Education Fund. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. As fall approaches, many people are lamenting the loss of their annual summer vacations. Others are considering a getaway as the temperatures change and fewer people flock to hotspots. But guidance about where and how to travel can be confusing. 90.5 WESA's Kylie Kozinski takes a look at what the experts recommend when it comes to planning a trip during a pandemic.
Scott Burke, a 47-year-old Pittsburgh resident, took a trip to Florida in August. He drove his own car the whole way and wore a face mask when he stopped for gas.
Like, I brought snacks, a cooler with me, so I didn't really have to stop. And always have hand sanitizer in my car. So, I mean, the biggest thing with me was, like, being responsible about my trip.
Burke credits those precautions with keeping him from contracting the virus. He tested negative at his doctor's office when he returned. He's been out of work since the statewide shutdown, so he didn't have to comply with an employer quarantine requirement.
I'd never want anybody to hear this and be like, well, he did it and he's fine. I'm a single guy who lives in an apartment that's not an apartment building. Like, I can very easily not be around people. And again, I'm out of work, so I didn't have a job to go back to. I don't have a spouse or children. I'm not around any elderly people.
But it's not that simple for most people, and the guidance from officials is all over the place. The state recommends a 14-day quarantine upon returning from a trip to a state with high case counts, like Florida. The University of Pittsburgh recommends its employees complete a 14-day quarantine regardless of where you travel. UPMC, the state's largest non-governmental employer, says its employees should monitor themselves but that they don't need to quarantine unless they have symptoms of COVID-19. Paradoxically, Allegheny County has endorsed both the state's and UPMC's guidelines. The Centers for Disease Control suggests monitoring for symptoms for 2 weeks after a trip and maintaining social distancing when out and about. Whether or not to travel is ultimately a matter of risk assessment. Here's Allegheny County Health Department Director Dr. Deborah Bogan at a recent press conference.
If you are taking a car and you're going into the woods and you're by yourself for 2 weeks on a vacation or a week, that is very low-risk travel. You're not likely to bring back COVID-19. If you traveled on multiple airplanes for long periods of time, you visited bars in some high-risk states, that's a very different exposure. So people need to use their common sense.
Most trips probably fall somewhere in the middle of those two extremes. The CDC, alongside state and local officials, recommend researching a location's COVID-19 case count before planning a trip there, and to consider postponing or heading somewhere else if case counts are high. Dr. David Dowsey is an epidemiologist and executive vice president and provost of Duquesne University. He says a lake cabin is a safe bet, but even with the right precautions and research, a beach trip can also be relatively low risk.
There's been a lot of press about beaches as being bad locations. The reality is they're outdoors and, you know, there's a lot of wind and high humidity and other things that are less than ideal for COVID-19. So certainly if you went to the beach and had your own spot, you can be fine.
If you have to fly or take a bus or train, try to select an off time for your trip. The last flight out in the evening, for example. Research your airline's policies, too. American and United Airlines return to full capacity flights this summer.
The safest way to actually travel right now is to get in a car and go somewhere. That's the best and surest way to. This is one of the reasons why rental cars are, you know, sort of way up right now.
Regardless of where you go, Dowsey says all should closely monitor for symptoms of COVID-19 upon returning from a trip. And since the list of potential symptoms is so long,
if you feel unwell in any way, you should talk to your healthcare provider and not go to work.
Most experts agree it's best not to travel right now. But if you're going to pack up and head out, do some research about your destination. Wear a face mask, wash your hands often, and keep your distance from other people outside of your traveling group. Kylie Kaczynski, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at WESA.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.